This week on The Score, what were the top science stories of 2018? We hear the hidden story of the stage play 12 Angry Men and why 1979 was such a pivotal year. All this and more on The Score. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere, and I wish all of our listeners a Happy New Year. That means you. The past 12 months have brought a lot of news in the world of science. Whether the headlines have featured climate change or CRISPR babies, the stories have given us plenty to talk about. On Christmas Eve, I spoke with science journalist Jackson Landers about the stories of 2018 that he believes will have staying power and could affect our lives in years to come.
I think the biggest science story this year is arguably everything SpaceX has done this year. That, you know, they had already kind of proven, hey, we can take a rocket and we can launch it and then like land, you know, pointing straight up, you know, reusing it like something out of a 1950s science fiction movie. And they've done it again and again and again. They've launched the BFR, they've launched the Falcon Heavy, and they've got the BFR that they're building right now. They have made return from orbit of rockets, you know, in a reusable way, completely routine. I think 2018 is probably the biggest year, arguably, in terms of history in space exploration and engineering since, like, the Apollo years.
Yeah, well, we're talking to Jackson Landers, a science journalist, and space has been a lot in the news. Just about a week ago, I think it was, Voyager left the heliosphere. It becomes an interstellar object launched by American.
Yeah. Voyager is a great story. One thing I wish we had done is, after launching Voyager, it would have been nice if we launched something similar every 5 years or so we'd have a chain of repeaters. You know, it's getting to the point where I'm not sure how much more we're going to get out of Voyager, just in terms of our ability to receive its signals. It's also, you can kind of look back at it, and you know, we wanted to make contact with extraterrestrials, and so we sent them naked selfies and a mixtape.
<Yeah. laughs>
You know, what up, girl?
From the President of the United
States. That's right.
They might try to track us down. Is that a dangerous thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure how well it was really thought out. If you get in touch with anyone and you're saying, well, we're here, we have these types of assets, you know, it's a pretty good planet, it supports life, you know, you come this way to get it. Yeah, it seems like something that, I'm not going to say I come down one way or another, but there really should have been a serious discussion that lasts many years before you do something like that. But it's a little late now. I mean, I would think that if another civilization intercepted, you know, either of those probes, if you just, you know, you just look at its trajectory and rewinds, and you can figure out where it came from.
Speaking of aliens, you wrote a book called Eating Aliens, and one of the things that you've been following over the years is invasive species. Are there any new invasive species that we should be worrying about in terms of food production or our daily lives?
Invasive species to worry about in terms of food production or daily lives, that is actually going to be less so the sort of sexy stuff like wild pigs and pythons, and more insects. You know, that's really like looking at insects and fungi that travel around the world in wood. Wood products, something that's in the hold of a ship that's just kind of used as like baffling, and it's not even declared as cargo often, or you have something that's in an actual shipping container. That's the stuff that has the little tiny things, you know, insects that can reproduce into the bill. billions and wipe out a crop. That's the stuff to watch out for. And that's actually the type of the work that I'm doing now at the University of Florida as a strategic communicator, strategic science communicator. That's the stuff my lab looks for. It's like, you know, what are those little insects? And I'm not going to say that this is necessarily the one to worry about, but my lab actually had a project in Cuba that started in the final years of the Obama administration as things were loosening up. They said, hey, wait a minute, if we're going to have trade with Cuba, are there any like forest pests or agricultural pests that if we start having ships going back and forth, is there something that could make that jump 90 miles and get here and be a problem? And so my lab actually got a grant, and that was the first project funded by USDA in something like 70 years to go and look at this kind of thing in Cuba, and actually did find. So our scientists went over and they found, yeah, there actually is. There's a bark beetle that's related. They found a new species of bark beetle. It's closely related to another one that can wipe out, billions of dollars worth of forests. And then the project got shut down because, you know, Trump people decided they didn't like Cuba anymore, and Cuba decided they didn't like Trump people. And there's incredible vulnerability. And actually, I got a story about it placed in Scientific American about a month ago, which was nice. But the Cubans have no ability to deal with it. So they've just built a new Panamax port that's a free trade zone. So there's going to be a lot of trade coming in and out of that port. And they have no ability to police it for invasive species moving around. I mean, they have people who are part of that biosecurity, but like, look, they get paid $30 a month. They don't have batteries for their flashlights. They don't have microscopes. You can't do this job. You're saying, what is this insect, you know, that we found flying around the port? You can't. I mean, these are smart, capable, well-trained people. Some of them are entomologists. Some of them are biologists. Some of them are just kind of, you know, lay people with a lot of training. And they have the will, but they're using Soviet-era equipment that's broken, and they have no ability to police that port for invasive species that are moving around that could cause famine and deforestation someday. That's a scary thing. That's something people should be watching out for.
I know this is a topic you've addressed in the past, but it seems like every few weeks I see an article in the newspaper about some scientists who are talking about recreating the mastodon or the woolly mammoth.
Yeah.
Is that something that's real?
No. Someday it could be. I mean, a mastodon would be unlikely. Mastodons range generally kind of farther south. And where we have really good genomes, where we have really good DNA to work with is from frozen animals. So the woolly mammoth was in the north, and there are places where it ended up in the permafrost, where you have tissue samples that have been frozen that whole time. I don't think we don't have any tissue like that I'm aware of from mastodons. So the woolly mammoth genome has been sequenced by a few people, by a few different labs for different purposes, and they probably needs a few more passes, kind of taking junk out of it, where you get like bits of pollen and things like that. But that's still not something that you could. It's still going to have enough. I mean, that's a genome that you can study and learn more about the animal from looking at it. But there are probably enough errors that if you tried to make that work in a cell, you'd get sort of congenital problems. You get all kinds of deformities and things. Someday we'll get to the point where we do have a good genome, but no one has ever taken built a genome and packed it into the nucleus of a cell. And if you did that with a mouse, you would win a Nobel Prize. You know, you're not going to do it with a mammoth first. You would do it. These are techniques that you would perfect with species that we know an awful lot about. And then so you have techniques like CRISPR-Cas9. The people like George Church are claiming that they're going to be able to use CRISPR tech, CRISPR. Watch videos on YouTube to see how it works. That would get you a couple of genes here and there that you could take. You know, it still wouldn't be a woolly mammoth. It would be a way to make a elephant more woolly mammoth-like. And I think that'd be really cool. But the problem is you don't have enough elephants to do that experiment with. You know, when you're trying to, like, you're doing something that in some cases it's a lot like, this basically involves somatic cloning, like Dolly the sheep. And when you do that for the first time with a new animal, it usually takes hundreds of attempts with hundreds of individual surrogate mothers to get the one live birth, because it's really hard to do. You know, I interviewed the guy who did this with ferrets. First, because ferrets are their lungs are a lot like human lungs. They're good to study. Ferret lungs are good, help understand human lung diseases, and so having a genetically consistent population helps experiments. And all told, I think his last round included like 300, but there were two other papers before that he had to build on. It was probably somewhere near 1,000 female ferrets that they had to attempt to implant an embryo in. That's an animal we know a lot about. You know, same thing with Dolly the sheep. It was like 300 or 400 attempts. So I added up once, when I worked on a story about this for the Washington Post. I spent a week counting every female Asian elephant, because you want the Asian elephants are more closely related to the mammoths. I added up every female Asian elephant of breeding age and condition in North America, and there were around 50.
Not a lot.
No. So if you got the entire population of captive female Asian elephants and put them into this breeding program, you probably still wouldn't get one live birth out of it. We just don't know that much about elephants. We don't know anything about their, not only say we don't know anything, we know very little about their reproductive systems. It's not like working with chickens or goats or something where you can dissect as many as you need to. You know, you could be a veterinarian that specializes in elephants and maybe only get to do one actual dissection in your entire life, right? It's just hard to get samples to understand, you know, the finer points of how their reproductive systems work, what hormones kick in at different times, and then just the cell biology. You couldn't, and you're not going to get 50 of those 50, because right now we're trying to save elephants from extinction. You can't really import elephants into North America anymore. Like, basically what's here is the population. So if we want to continue having them, you know, captive elephants in zoos and as sort of a lifeboat population, you know, you got to focus on making more elephants. You know, those zookeepers are not going to let you do abdominally unnecessary surgery on their elephants when they're trying to, you know, you've got a female elephant that can have a baby, they want that to be another elephant. So someday this could be done, maybe 50 years from now, 100 years from now, but first you got to save elephants. So if you want to see woolly mammoths, save elephants first, and when we have a lot of elephants, then you can start using them like cows and doing experiments on them.
Well, speaking of elephants, which are among the most intelligent animals we know about, we seem to be learning a lot about intelligent animals that have the equivalent of a human brain. I mean, I've been saying recently that if dolphins had hands, we would be in real trouble. What do you know about research into the intelligence of other animals, like other primates or birds or sea mammals?
Yeah, we keep learning that animals are more intelligent than we thought. Actually, the cephalopods, which is a group of animals that includes squids and octopuses, those will really surprise you. They're capable of what you could start verging on calling intelligent behavior. And it's especially with the aquatic stuff, it's so hard to study. Mm-hmm. You know, whales might be brilliant, but you can't keep them in a tank.
Right.
You know, to figure out how to communicate with them. It's a little bit of a messy area where, you know, what do you consider intelligence? You know, how do you want to define what it is to be self-aware? You know, there's a lot of behavior that we as humans engage in that seems sort of intelligent, but is actually unconscious, right? Like playing the piano, ability for something to play the piano, play a complex piece by Chopin, you could say that's intelligent. On the other hand, if you talk to piano players, when they're playing the piano, they don't think, now my finger goes here and then I do that. And it's unconscious behavior.
It's like muscle memory.
Yeah, exactly. Muscle memory is a handy term that's completely inaccurate, but there's quite a lot of things that human beings do, or driving a car is actually unconscious behavior. My mind can wander and be like, how did I get here? You know, I'm not necessarily thinking all the time about, like, and now I'm going to put on my turn signal, and now I'm going to turn the wheel this way. It's unconscious behavior. So, yeah, I guess there's a lot of interesting questions to ask about then what the nature of consciousness is. You could look at maybe a dolphin and you could say, you know, this is intelligent behavior. Does it mean that they're self-aware? I don't know. Yeah, there's big questions to ask along the way.
That is the major question to ask, is the self-awareness and the awareness that other creatures are self-aware. One of the things they taught various gorillas to speak in sign language.
That's right, yeah.
But they can't ask questions because they don't have this awareness that the person they're talking to knows things that they don't know.
Coco just died. You know that?
Yeah,
just in the past year. There was
year,
that this is one of the list of people we've lost in 2018. Coco. But I guess it would be really interesting to see, assuming that these lineages of gorillas are allowed to keep having offspring and teaching their offspring. Like, yeah, they're not asking questions like that, like you say right now, but you wonder what happens after a few generations. You know, if language enables, you know, the acquisition of some of these other cognitive abilities. Who knows?
Well, we'll find out in 2019 or 2020 or 2021. Jack, great talking to you, and thanks for the insights on science over the past year.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
On this week's episode of The Score, I'm relying heavily on our audio archives, although, as always, we have a mix of old and new. In this recording from the archives, I talked to lawyer and legal ethicist Jack Marshall about the hidden, behind-the-scenes role he played in transforming 12 Angry Men from a classic film starring Henry Fonda into a successful stage production. Jack was one of the founders of the late lamented American Century Theater in Arlington, Virginia. Our conversation took place during the run of that company's final production in July 2015.
Jack, you were instrumental in turning what was once a famous movie into a very successful stage play. Tell us that story.
Well, it's a very strange story. When 12 Angry Men was began as a TV one-hour drama, live drama for Studio One. It was pretty successful, but it wasn't viewed as having any larger commercial value until Henry Fonda got a hold of it and decided that the part of Juror 8, who is the so-called lone juror who votes not guilty in a murder trial when everyone else is convinced it's an open and shut case, Henry thought that this fit his persona of Mr. Roberts, Abe Lincoln, Tom Joad, and wanted to make a movie out of it. And he teamed up with the screenwriter, Reginald Rose. Nobody really wanted to do it. They thought that a play that was all in one room with 12 guys, no violence, and essentially all talk would have no box office potential. But they made the movie anyway, with Fonda in the starring role and a couple of well-known stars, but mostly unknowns. And it was a box office flop, though it was a critical failure. It got some Academy Award nominations, but both Henry Fonda and Reginald Rose lost their shirts on this, and they didn't think that it was going anywhere. So Rose went ahead and sold the stage rights for this play to the only licensing house that was interested in buying it, and it wasn't even a major licensing house. That, as a result of that, what was ultimately available if you wanted to do the stage version of 12 Angry Men was an adaptation of the play with it turned into a three acts with intermissions, and this pretty much destroys the whole tension of the movie, which is the fact that it's done in real time and it's continuous that makes it work. This was the only version you could legally get to do the play, and I had long been an admirer of the movie, which started becoming very popular in the 60s after all of those unknowns who were in 12 Angry Men and the other nine parts had become major stars, people like Jack Klugman and Jack Warden, Martin Balsam. These were all people that were unknown when the 1956 play came out, but by the time it started being rerun on TV, it made the movie look like an all-star cast. So I assumed that since a play was advertised, it would have been written by Reginald Rose and, in fact, would be essentially the same as the movie, because I saw nothing in the movie that made it unsuitable for stage. But I was wrong. You couldn't get it. So I basically had my poor wife help me, because I can't type. This was back before the internet and before you could get even DVDs. So we actually rented a reel-to-reel version of 12 Angry Men and then taped it. And then my wife Grace typed it up using a dictating machine. So we actually had a transcript, and I did a special version for the Georgetown University Law Center of the play exactly as the movie, putting it on stage, and it was a huge hit. And that was 30 years ago. And about 10 years after that, at a request of the Association of Trial Lawyers, I did it again. And that one spawned my current theater, which is about to sort of close its doors, declaring victory, the American Century Theater, which made itself made its mission being to do plays that other theater companies either didn't do or thought they couldn't do. So our first show was 12 Angry Men, and for that I called up Reginald Rose and I said, look, I feel bad about this. We're paying royalties to the company that has the stage rights, but I'm actually doing your show, and it works great on stage, just the way you wrote it for the film. And he said, thank you. That's great. I love that. That's wonderful. I don't care if you pay them. That makes them happy. I'm just happy to see this get on stage the way it's supposed to be. That production was also a huge success, and I sent him the reviews, and I sent him information about it. And somewhere around this, and this was sometime after 1994, when we did that show, Reginald Rose, then in his 70s, began negotiating with Showtime to do a new version of the a new updated version of the movie, which he did. And because that was a successful one, went about the job of talking Broadway producers and managed gradually to get a the stage rights for professional productions back. He died before the version ever made it to Broadway, but in fact it did make it to Broadway. And now when you do the stage version of 12 Angry Men, you can get the version that Reginald Rose wanted to do, which is essentially the version we're doing right now. So you won't see this story in Wikipedia or anywhere else, because it really was all sort of behind the scenes. But the fact is that due to a lot of factors, but part of it was that we were able to show that this script works on stage. Reginald Rose finally was able to get back his work and get the stage rights back.
Well, maybe if it's not on Wikipedia, at least people can use this as the original source material for the story of how 12 Angry Men was transformed from a movie to a stage play. But let's go around full circle, Jack. What are the sort of the ethical ramifications of the play 12 Angry Men? It's a very dramatic story, but it's all about justice.
It's
apply?
Widely misunderstood from an ethical standpoint, because what it isn't about is how one guy realizes that a defendant is not guilty, is innocent of what he did, and manages to prove it through the course of the play. What it is about is how bias makes us stupid, and how all the jurors, and even arguably Juror 8, the Henry Fonda rule, have decided that they understand the case and that it's open and shut for reasons that really, as the play unfolds, don't have as much to do with the evidence as their own distortions of reality, confirmation bias, racial bias, ethnic bias. Who are the people they want to be associated with? Who do they respect? And how they go about the job of deciding what justice is. It's a real sausage-making process, which is, in fact, is the jury, which is, in fact, a fractal of democracy. It shows how Reginald Rose wanted to show how you can put very, very diverse individuals who would never be in the same place at the same time, who reason differently, whose values are differently, and tell them you have to come up with consensus about whether this person is going to be electrocuted or not. And all of the impediments to that, which really is a miniature version of democracy itself. And what you learn watching this is how hard it is to do the right thing when all our individual experiences, who do we like, who don't we like, our misunderstandings, all of these things can get in the way of pure reason and fairness. And ultimately, all that happens in 12 Angry Men is they reach the point of reasonable doubt. The kid on trial for killing his father, I would say, is probably guilty if it had to be determined on the basis of a predominance of the evidence, like we do with civil cases. I think he would be convicted. But beyond a reasonable doubt is a really tough standard. And clearly, once the eyewitness testimony of the only two witnesses is called into question in various ways, then there is no eyewitness, there is no reasonable doubt. And this explains why cases like the O.J. case and Casey Anthony, things like this, are frustrating to everybody, because we think we know that the defendants are guilty, but the prosecution did not meet its burden of proof. So this is also both an exercise in how you reach a just and fair conclusion in complex circumstances, but also how the American legal system works and one of its strengths. And for that reason, that's why this is a classic, and that's why in the production yesterday, somebody spoke up and said there's nothing about this play that goes out of date, even though it's played in 1956. And that's because the issues taken up here and the themes will never go out of date. Justice, bias, the inherent fallibility of people and their humanity, and the flawed ways we all go about making our decisions.
Just as a personal note, let me add that I've known Jack Marshall almost as long as I've known anyone in Virginia. He and I both performed in a production of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum during my first month as a freshman at Georgetown University. I was a Protean, he was Senex. I won't mention what year it was, but you can look it up if you're curious.
Happy New Year from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Critics and audiences are praising Barry Jenkins' new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. Despite the lofty award season buzz, The Score's film critic, Tim Halsey, takes a contrary view.
African-American director Barry Jenkins made a splash at the 2016 Oscars for his film Moonlight, a coming-of-age tale about a gay African-American boy growing up on the streets of Miami. His follow-up film, If Beale Street Could Talk, is arguably more artistically ambitious than Moonlight, but much less successful overall. Adapted from the 1974 novel of the same name by black gay author and social critic James Baldwin, this tale of an unwed teenage mother whose boyfriend is unjustly tossed into prison on a trumped-up rape charge is a surprisingly dull and listless affair. Where Baldwin's novel erupted in fiery protests against America, clueless whites, or any other issue that happened to enter his field of vision, including God himself, Jenkins' film offers long, fetishized depictions of its two young leads, Kiki Lane and Stephen James, often in various states of undress. Jenkins obviously wants to capture the lyrical qualities of Baldwin's prose on film, and rightly so, for without that lyricism, Baldwin's novel would have been just another social realist screed. The problem is that Jenkins' idea of cinematic lyricism is merely aestheticized inertia. Jenkins does resist the urge to prettify a few things. A rape victim's cry of anger and terror toward the end of the film provides a few seconds of unvarnished truth, though the varnish returns in force shortly thereafter. For the most part, the images in If Beale Street Could Talk are so meticulously lit, so gauzy, that they feel like kitschy Hallmark cards. Where Baldwin's novel confronts the poverty and oppression of his characters, Jenkins makes it pretty and appealing. Although the film, like the novel, is set in New York City during the 1970s, the locations we see in the film are so thoroughly sanitized, portrayed in such nostalgically saturated amber hues, that they fail to evoke a sense of either time or place. The film fares little better with its characters, who come across as either plaster saints or cardboard villains. We seldom hear these characters speak to each other, and only in one early scene, a confrontation in which the young mother discloses her pregnancy to her extended family, do we have a sense of a strong conflict within the same room. It's also the only scene with even the slightest semblance of humor in it, though unfortunately, the family's token advocate of traditional morality gets shut down a little too quickly. Jenkins squanders a potentially promising subplot with the couple's respective fathers, played by Coleman Domingo and Michael Beach. These two steal clothes from the garment district, sell them on the street in Harlem, and save the proceeds to pay for the young man's criminal defense. It's an interesting side story, but we see very little of it, apart from a few scenes in which the middle-aged men swap bromides in a local bar. But the film's political agenda is admirably suited to the moment, with its focus on what we've come to call mass incarceration. Jenkins has altered a few details in the novel, including the ending, to make the political connection a bit more explicit. On the whole, though, the political angle seems less like a call to end the imprisonment of African-American men and more like a call for right-minded Academy voters to bestow some nominations on a work that is mostly devoid of either tension or interest. It's probably a good thing that Beale Street can't talk, for if it could, it might tell you that Barry Jenkins' If Beale Street Could Talk is an all-around bore.
Happy New Year from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Jonathan Bidlack is founder and president of the Coalition to Reduce Spending, a single-issue advocacy group in Washington whose mission is in its name. I spoke to Bidlack by telephone a few days before Christmas, just before the partial government shutdown began.
My first question is about the farm bill that just got passed earlier this month. I know that your group has been critical of that, but it was a major issue, and I'd like to find out what your criticisms were about.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the argument that has long been made for agricultural assistance is that farming is a core part of the American economy, and we ultimately need to have food. And so, you know, in the past, obviously, it was a pretty tough lifestyle, I guess you could say, to be a farmer. And so we needed to make sure that we were encouraging domestic production of food sufficient for, you know, the American people. Now, obviously, the world is a little bit different and the country is a little bit different today than it might have been, you know, 100 or 50 years ago. First of all, I mean, when you talk about the Farm Bill specifically and the subsidies that it provides, by and large, they're going to support the biggest agribusinesses. They're not, you know, this, the myth is sort of that we're supporting the small family farmer, but even to the degree that your local family farmer might be receiving, you know, federal assistance, they're not getting anywhere near as much as the large agribusiness that dominates the agricultural industry today. And so in many ways, they're actually being harmed, very directly. And, you know, I mean, look, I mean, from a conservative or libertarian standpoint, I mean, you know, you can ask the question about whether or not this is really a legitimate function of government today. I mean, you know, agriculture is an important part of the American economy, but there are a lot of important parts of the American economy, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we need, you know, antiquated systems of subsidies to, you know, to prop up that industry and you know, relative to others. And so, you know, there's that argument. But even if you don't necessarily buy into the, you know, what might be considered a more ideological argument, you still have the question of, you know, can we afford this? I mean, the Farm Bill, you know, basically would be spending, I think the estimate from the CBO is something like $860 billion over 10 years. That's the biggest Farm Bill ever. And you know, that doesn't even account for some of the discretionary spending, so that's not even a complete estimate. Look, we have a $21 trillion national debt that's growing. We have government that's growing by the day, and the Farm Bill is one part of that. And, you know, I think ultimately it's just not really something we can afford. And frankly, it's probably not something that we even should be, you know, worrying about.
We're talking with Jonathan Bidlack of the Coalition to Reduce Spending. And before we get into some of the substance of what's gone on over the past year, could you tell us a bit about what the Coalition to Reduce Spending is? What's your mission? How do you accomplish what you want to accomplish?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so we're basically I always like to say a single issue organization, but our issue is all issues, because of course, you know, spending and it touches all aspects of the federal budget. But essentially, you know, we're a transparency organization or a fiscal conservative watchdog, I guess you could say, that tries to shed light on what's happening in the federal budget and to seek for basically solutions to create more responsible levels of federal spending. You know, we have a government that's growing larger by the day, and as we know, our budget deficits and national debt have increased dramatically, and so our basic goal is to get as many people as possible to be aware of what's happening with respect to the federal budget, and also to try to show who's responsible for some of these outcomes that we see. And so one of our big projects is spendingtracker.org, which allows you to basically, you know, type in your zip code and see how much spending your member of Congress is voting for. And the idea here is to not just say, hey, you know, the government's spending a lot, we all know that, but to really start to create some accountability and show how much, you know, our individual elected officials are actually ultimately responsible for.
Are there any members of Congress who you could call heroes in the war of cutting spending?
Yeah, I think there are some. I mean, you know, it's probably some of the names that I imagine might be familiar to people on your program. You know, in the Senate, you've got the Rand Pauls and, you know, people who maybe have a little bit more of a libertarian bent. In the House, you have, you know, Justin Amash, who's consistently been at the top, and Thomas Massey and some of the other members of the Freedom Caucus. So, you know, it shakes out in some ways how you would expect. In other ways, not necessarily. I mean, the reality is that, you know, when you look at that distribution, most members of Congress are voting for really large amounts of spending. And, you know, that's not just things like the Farm Bill, but it's everything from, you know, really large Pentagon spending packages to just all sorts of, you know, little things along the way that add up into you know, big amounts of spending. So I wish I could tell you that, you know, there were you know, we had a couple dozen or, you know, a couple hundred members who are really committed to fiscal responsibility. But unfortunately, it's relatively few members. And frankly, both parties are oftentimes complicit in some of the irresponsible outcomes that we see.
During the past year, 2018, were there any examples of portions of the budget being cut, any particular programs that were reduced from what their previous spending levels were the last time there was a budget?
You know, probably not too many. I mean, obviously there are always little items that are, you know, where funds are shifted around or what have you, but it's not like there's some prominent program that was ended in the last year. I will make a couple of comments, I mean, in this regard. I mean, one is that, you know, the president's budget, to his credit and to Mick Mulvaney's credit, did actually propose, you know, significant cuts to a number of discretionary-oriented programs. And so now, obviously, a budget is not binding, and those were not enacted, but there at least was an attempt to at least, you know, put out sort of a blueprint as to how we might go and begin to cut certain things. So that was perhaps a little bit encouraging. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, not a whole lot. I mean, you know, the bigger thing, I think, if you want to look for sort of the optimistic side of the coin, you know, you can look at some of the things that have actually been talked about just in the last week. I mean, you know, if we do end up, you know, bringing troops home from Syria, for example, that can have an advantageous impact on the federal budget. So there are certain things like that. You know, the First Step Act, which, you know, passed the Senate and just passed the House as well, and is likely to be signed by the president, will hopefully reduce the burden of you know, prison expenses at the federal level. So, you know, look, these aren't necessarily really huge items from a cost-saving standpoint, but they are steps in the right direction, and they are a rethinking of what the role of government is and should be in these areas. And so those are probably some, you know, a few of the more recent items that might qualify for a little optimism.
I guess what you're saying is that sometimes spending can be reduced or at least changed, not by focusing on the spending itself, but on the policies that use the money from the federal government. And by changing policies, you can reduce the size and scope of government almost as a concomitant advantage.
Well, you know, one of the ways that I like to talk about this, you know, you always see these charts. Someone inevitably will do an article where they say, you know, this is how much the national debt increased under Barack Obama, and this is how much the national debt increased under George Bush, and you know, I'm sure we're going to see those under President Trump as well. And those articles always miss the point a little bit because, you know, we all know that some of the spending, for example, that's taking place right now under President Trump is from programs that were set in motion during the Obama presidency. I mean, Obamacare, for example, would probably be the best, you know, easiest example of that. And the same thing was true during the Obama administration. There were, you know, for example, some of our foreign policy expenditures were because of policies that were set in motion during the George Bush years. And so, you know, oftentimes what happens is that a lot of these programs, you know, they just develop inertia behind them, and it becomes very difficult to stop them. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, when you start changing your perception of what the role of government is, and that leads you to change some of these sort of big picture policies, you might not necessarily see the cost savings immediately, but what it does do oftentimes is create sort of an incentive in the future to have lower spending. You know, if we don't have troops in Syria, for example, you know, that might save some money today, but think about all of the future savings that accrues from that policy. And so, you know, oftentimes a lot of our focus is on trying to get people to realize that if you don't set some of these programs in motion to begin with, it will have a very positive impact on the federal budget, not just in the short term, but in the medium to long term as well.
And every time a federal program begins, it either creates or solidifies a very particular constituency for that program that is willing to go to Congress to demand that the program be maintained or expanded. You could have a president as budget conscious as Calvin Coolidge, but if the Congress is not as receptive to the reductions in spending that people want in general, they're not going to change the programs.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, a lot of people are very critical of President Trump and you know, the way that you know, government has continued to grow over the last 2 years, and that's certainly a part of it. But you know, look, I mean, at the end of the day, the president doesn't make the laws. Congress is the one that's ultimately in charge of sending those laws to the president's desk. And so, you know, oftentimes that's where the blame and you know, theoretically where the credit should lie, I think. And you're right. I mean, that's the, you know, oftentimes you have Congress that's basically, everyone is sort of looking for their special program because of the very specialized constituency that, you know, provides them with campaign funds or is important in their particular district or what have you. And so, you know, this has been much written about, but it's basically you have very concentrated benefits and you have very diffuse, you know, drawbacks. And, you know, of course, when you add up all those programs, we all end up paying a large amount of tax dollars to support programs that aren't necessarily something that benefit us at all. But because of all those little individual special interests going and lobbying for their sort of pet projects or pet programs, you know, this is why these things stay in law.
We've got about 45 seconds left. I was wondering what you're looking at for 2019. Are there changes in the budgetary or appropriations process that you think can help reduce spending, or is it just going after things program by program, appropriations bill by appropriations bill?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I'm optimistic on the front of budget process reform. There was recently a joint select committee that didn't end up going and passing any sort of budgetary reforms, but there was a lot of progress made in terms of getting members of Congress to talk about these issues and think about how some of these process reforms might be beneficial. So I'm hopeful that in the next Congress we'll end up seeing these members coming together again and talking more substantively and perhaps getting some legislation that'll end up reforming the budget process and sort of hopefully changing the incentives a little bit so that that members don't always feel compelled to just vote for more and more spending. And obviously I mentioned our spending tracker project, but I think a big part of that picture too is just having citizens being aware of how much their members are voting for and being able to hold them accountable from the outside. So I strongly encourage your listeners to check out spendingtracker.org as well as the new Congress and kind of track how their member is doing.
Well, Jonathan, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. We'll be watching these issues throughout the coming months, and I want to wish you a happy new year.
Great. Happy new year to you too, and thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
During 2019, we will be marking the 40th anniversaries of multiple events that occurred in 1979. That year is the subject of Christian Carl's book, Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. I interviewed him in May 2013, shortly after the book was published. Toward the end of the interview, we discussed the then-recent Boston Marathon bombing. From the archives, here is journalist Christian Carl.
The title of my new book is Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. And it's a book about exactly what it says, about the year 1979, about five key events that I argue shaped the world we live in today.
I'm going to ask the meta question that you sort of addressed in your earlier remarks. What sparked your interest in this topic and what launched you on the project that turned it into a book?
Well, originally, because I was a Newsweek reporter reporting on the war in Afghanistan, I wanted to write a book about Afghanistan. I became very fascinated while I was there with the profound contradiction between the Afghanistan that I experienced after 9/11 with the American intervention there, the war on terror, and so on and so forth, and the Afghanistan that existed in the 1970s, which was a completely radically different place, as I soon came to appreciate. So originally I thought about writing a book about Afghanistan, but then I realized there was a bigger story to tell, and that's kind of the genesis of the book, really.
What are the five case studies that you cover in the book?
Well, there are five stories. There's the Iranian Revolution, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. John Paul II, the newly elected pope, goes back to his Polish homeland for the first time in the summer of 1979. Then there's the election of British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, which was May 1979. And certainly last but certainly not least is the start of economic reform in China, which in many ways is the biggest story of them all.
And there were a lot of other events happening in 1979 that you left on the cutting room floor. Someone earlier mentioned the rise of Hun Sen in Cambodia. I thought about the three African dictators who were all deposed that year,
yes.
Idi Amin, Jean-Baptiste Lokassa, and Macias Nguema. Do you cover any of those issues at all, even peripherally in the book?
No, I don't cover Africa in the book. I don't cover Hun Sen. The biggest omission from the book is probably the Egypt-Israel peace accords, which were signed in March 1979. And I left that out because even though I think that was a very important event, it's just not part of the story that I wanted to tell, really. It was a very important event, I think, but it's a very ambiguous event. In some ways, it changed a lot, and in some ways, it didn't change very much. So it's kind of an event that cuts in two directions, whereas I felt that the five events that I'm describing in this book weren't just big, important events. They were big, important events that changed the very terms of the debate. They changed the way we think about economics and politics. So they weren't just important events in their own right. They actually changed the words, the language, the concepts that we use to describe these things.
You draw something of a contrast between the events of 1979 and what happened about a dozen years later, the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Were these events and trends in the late 70s leading up to the end of the Soviet Union?
Oh, very definitely. I think that's one of the things that interests me about this moment. This is the moment when the Soviet Union really gets a big crack in its armor, and when the appeal of communism, which I think is already quite thin by 1979, when it really, I think there's a real inflection point here, a real turning point, when the real fundamental weakness of the Soviet idea becomes apparent to everyone. And the China story is very much about this as well. One of the big events in my book is when Deng Xiaoping, the newly enshrined Chinese leader, comes to Washington to finalize diplomatic recognition with the United, between, you know, mutual diplomatic recognition between China and the United States. And that is precisely an expression of this widening sense that Soviet Union is not the other, is not the alternative idea anymore. There's something else out there that is going to occupy the minds of the coming generation. The Soviet Union has kind of been there, done that at this point.
People talk about the Arab Spring of 2011 as being the revolution that was on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the Iranian Revolution of 1979 was the revolution that was televised. Tell me a bit about the communications technologies that these strange rebels were using to facilitate their revolutions.
Well, I argue in the book that the 1970s is really the decade when globalization takes off in earnest. And certainly part of that story is the story of satellite communications. They'd already been around for a while, but by the late 70s, the costs were down to the level where, for example, an American TV crew in Tehran can send a really long package of video information over the telephone wires back, well, through the satellite, back to New York. And that's one of the reasons why the Iranian Revolution is the first televised revolution, because cheap satellite communications have enabled such a fast flow of information that it's completely changed the rules of the game. The real networking technology, though, in the countries that I'm describing is the humble cassette tape, because cassette tapes at this point are very mobile, very easy to use, and above all, they're cheap. So they play an enormous role in Iran, in politics in Poland, and even to some extent in China, where the cassette tape is the medium of pop culture from Taiwan and other parts of the Chinese-speaking world into mainland China. And I think all of that is actually hugely influential in a way that people haven't thought about before. Certainly in Iran, cassette recordings of Ayatollah Khomeini's sermons and speeches were enormously important.
Finally, I just want to shift gears and talk about your recent article that you investigated the influences on the Boston Marathon bomber.
Yeah.
Can you just describe what you discovered and what implications that might have for the further investigation?
Well, I talked to people who knew the Tsarnaevs extremely well, intimately indeed, I would say. I also examined their websites, their social media, use of social media in some detail. And it seems to me that what we have here is we're dealing with perhaps something of an outlier. I mean, in many respects, their case is so unusual and so different that, you know, we may not see exactly the same configuration in the future. But what I think is quite striking and perhaps very threatening is this notion of the lone wolf terrorists who form their convictions almost in isolation from people around them. And it really has so much to do with the internet and with this kind of global, this virtual community of jihadis in the internet, that you almost don't need people around you talking about this stuff anymore. The internet is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating, really, about the Tsarnaevs is the isolation in which they became what they became. And I do think that bodes, has somewhat ominous significance for the kind of terrorism we're going to see in the future.
From your investigation, were both brothers radicalized, or was the younger brother simply working under the influence of his older brother?
I think the younger brother is very much a story of the influence of the older brother. The one aspect of this story that really is very Chechen, characteristically Chechen, is the fact that the older brother had this enormous influence within the family, and that's very characteristic. In other ways, the Tsarnaevs had very little to do with Chechen culture and the whole Chechen story. But the one thing that sticks out is that in Chechen families, it's the oldest son who is has enormous authority and wields enormous influence within the family. And I really think that here we're dealing with a case where he lorded it over his younger brother to a really extraordinary degree, and ultimately kind of fateful extent.
Well, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate your comments.
Oh, no, it's completely my pleasure, and I hope you get some good mileage out of it.
Our final interview, drawn from the archives this week, features Josh Wheeler, now the former president of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. In March 2017, we talked about the future of journalism in an era of fake news. From the 2017 Virginia Festival of the Book in Charlottesville, here's Josh Wheeler. Joshua Wheeler, Thomas Jefferson Center for the
Protection of Free Expression.
Okay. Welcome to Bering Drift.
Thank you.
I just want to ask you a couple of quick questions about some things that are in the news.
Okay.
Primarily, I want to talk about the proliferation of the term fake news.
Okay.
What comes to mind when you hear that term?
I'm not exactly sure. What comes to mind to me is satire, but that's not how it's being used. The way in which it's being used by our current administration, which seems to really coin the phrase, is claiming that the news that they don't like is fake news, that it's just not correct. And that's not right. Whereas I believe that they have every right to find fault with journalism that they disagree with, that they think is not being correct, but to call it fake news is very disturbing to me, because it's really an attack on the institution of the press more than just any particular news outlet.
When the term first started being used last year, it seemed to refer specifically to Macedonian hackers in their basements writing absolutely phony news stories that got spread on the internet. In that context, what can social media do to defend themselves against that sort of thing?
That's a very good question. I'm not exactly sure. I think the key is just for, it's not really social media, but it's incumbent upon us as individuals to read a variety of sources, and only through that, I think, will we be able to get a filter of what actually is the truth and what is some sort of outlandish, just like demonstrably false information.
What are some criteria that people can use to determine what is a good news source versus what's a bad news source?
Well, I think it's always going to... One of the things I've learned in the last few years is I do think that news can have a bias or leaning one way or the other. There is a subjective element to the news. I think what we want to look for, though, is news reporters and news outlets that don't deliberately do that. That they are presenting what they see as the truth, and we, again, as the public, need to recognize that they are acting as a filter to us. And there's always going to be a certain amount of interpretation. But it's difficult to say. Again, I think the best way is to not just read or hear or listen to those news outlets that we know we're going to agree with, but to challenge ourselves and listen to some of those new media outlets that present a different point of view. And sometimes by doing that, you can recognize when they're reporting the same facts, but they might be reporting a slightly different interpretation of them, and then we are left free to make our own interpretation. I believe very strongly in the phrase that you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And what seems to concern me today is that so many people are relying on, are putting forth statements, claiming facts, when in fact there's no real evidence to prove that.
The whole concept of alternative facts.
Exactly, alternative facts. That's an example of it. Right.
Just a quick shift of questioning. Are there any free speech or free expression cases working their way through the courts right now that we should be aware of?
There are, and I'm suddenly just drawing a blank because we're involved in several of them. There are a number of press cases and things that are going through the courts. I'll tell you one case. It's not at the Supreme Court yet, and it may not be, but one that's arisen in Pennsylvania, and it's an issue we're going to see more and more of. It involves a number of issues, which is internet speech, one, but two, what constitutes a true threat. True threats are one of those areas and categories of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment. The whole question then is what constitutes a true threat? And in subject, when it's on the internet, it's particularly difficult because when it's a true threat, you often think has to be communicated to a particular person. But what if it's not intended to be communicated, directed towards a particular person, but that person feels threatened by the statement? The issue there is, does a true threat, is it defined by the actual intent of the speaker? Does the speaker have to intend to make you feel threatened? Or is it just enough that the listener, the person who hears it, is reasonable in feeling threatened by it? And that's a critical issue that the Supreme Court has yet to weigh in on. They've had a couple of chances, and both times they sort of punted on that issue. But it's going to come up, and it's coming up in this case in Pennsylvania right now.
That's all the time we have on this year-end episode of The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I offer my wishes for a peaceful, prosperous, and truly terrific 2019. We'll be back next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. Be sure to tell your friends where to find us and take part in the conversation. You can always leave comments on BeringDrift.com. I'm Rick Sincere, and I'll see you next year.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.